Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Eating Tools, unique handmade cooking tools. For more information, visit eatingtools.com.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from Brooklyn, New York. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every daily supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cook guests. My guest today is Whit Johnson, who is the co-founder of Ryzen Spirits, based in Atlanta, Georgia. Whit founded Ryzen Spirits in April 2021 to produce very unique products that blends Japanese tradition and American terroir. More specifically, he chose to use Japanese koji malt, which is the foundational ingredient of Japanese cuisine, to produce his spirits instead of malts that are used for whiskeys. Also, Whit uses Carolina gold rice, which reflects the rich history of American South agriculture, and it is very exciting to see the two cultures are beautifully merged in his products. So today we'll discuss how Whit got into the spirit industry after his successful career in an entire different industry, the difference between koji and malt-based fermentation, and how a traditional Southern American rice naturally merges with Japanese traditional koji and much, much more. But before we start, Japan Eats is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, whichever you listen to, and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Now, let's start a conversation with Whit Johnson. Hello, Whit. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Kiko, how are you? I appreciate you having me on today.
Yeah, this is very exciting. So to get to know you first, where are you from and what did you eat when you grew up?
So I'm originally from South Carolina. I spent kind of the first part of my childhood in Charleston and then kind of my latter years in Columbia, the state capital. And as far as what did I eat, I would say that most weekdays, so breakfast and lunch, was pretty standard fare, right? Cereals and school lunches and whatnot. But, I came from a fairly traditional family that, you know, and some evenings, but certainly on the weekends, we would do large meals. That really came from my father's side of the family and from my grandmother, my paternal grandmother. And a lot of what we ate was local, a lot of local fruits and vegetables. So strawberries, watermelon, you know, seasonal black-eyed peas, local cucumbers, onions, that kind of thing. And then a lot of, you know, barbecued meats. We would do, you know, grilled Boston butts, lots of chicken, stuff like that. But for the most part, I mean, it was fairly seasonal, and a lot of local stuff that you know, you could pick up at roadside stands really on the highway.
Mm, wow. You say it very smoothly, but it sounds like a dream diet from the South.
Yeah, I mean, it was certainly a Southern diet, right? I mean, there were a lot of things that were fried and a lot of oils used. It kind of kept us going. It was a lot of calories. But yeah, I mean, it was, you know, looking back, you realize how much like time and work and preparation went into it. And they were great meals. I mean, I wish I could say that I still ate those same meals. But, you know, those were meals that, looking back at my mother and father putting that stuff together, I mean, there were meals that sometimes took an hour or two to put together.
Mm, right. Okay, well, hopefully somebody is going to continue doing that. Right, so, and then you founded Horizon Spirits to produce your own spirits in 2021. So, and but used to be in very different industries. So what was your background before that? And how did you get into the spirit production business?
Yeah, so I lived in Atlanta for about the last 12 years. I was in real estate, and more specifically, I was in real estate development, building apartment buildings. And really, the genesis of all this stuff started back in 2014. I had read an article, some kind of a generic business news article. It might have been a Bloomberg article or something like that, but it was talking about Diageo, and Diageo puts out these annual statistics, and it was speaking specifically about the world's most consumed alcoholic beverage, and it was Baijiu, Chinese Baijiu. And I had never heard anything about Baijiu. I didn't even know what it was or that it existed. And so I read more about it, and you know, it kind of makes sense when you look at the amount of people that live in China. And you know, it was, what was interesting to me was that it's made from a variety of different things. It's, some of it's made from rice, but a lot of it's made from sorghum. But being from South Carolina, I knew about Carolina gold rice, and I, you know, it kind of got my, you know, internal gears going. And I thought, you know, it would be interesting if there was a way to make a distilled spirit out of rice, because South Carolinians are almost like second to Texas in terms of like the love for their state. And I felt like, you know, if you could deliver a spirit made from rice, South Carolinians would probably love it. And so I did a deeper dive into Baijiu. I don't think Baijiu translates very well to a Western audience. It's a very high ABV. And it's definitely something that you kind of have to get acquired to. But in my searches, I came across Japanese shochu. And Japanese shochu, especially Honkaku Japanese shochu, seemed more refined. The taste profiles were exquisite. You know, I started to purchase some sample bottles and really got into it. And you looked at the history of it, you know, really going back several thousand years for sake, and then, you know, going back 500 to 600 years for the production of shochu. And it was really interesting. And so, you know, it kind of like somebody who gets into beer, you go out and you buy the kit, you kind of like start to figure out how to make it. Well, I did something similar, but they don't really make shochu kits. So there was a lot more reading involved. I mean, I had a handful of books that I purchased on, you know, how to make sake, because the process for fermenting or fermentation and growing koji malt is very similar. So I kind of learned almost how to make sake before I learned how to make shochu. But I kind of pieced all these things together and kind of like figured out how to make it. And I really, I put it down for several years and didn't do much with it. I made a few sample batches and people enjoyed it, and friends and family and whatnot. But it really wasn't until about, gosh, maybe 5-6 years later that I had a buddy of mine come along, and we were exchanging ideas. And I told him about this concept that I had. And he said, you should really take that further. And I said, you know, I'm just kind of busy with life in general and career and all of that stuff. And I said, if you would like to join in, by all means, I'd love to have you to help out. And so he came on board, and we really got into it in a big way. I mean, we started reaching out to the Clemson University Coastal Extension and speaking to people in their agricultural department. And, you know, we, you know, started reaching out to people in Stuttgart at the University of Arkansas and their agricultural departments to really do a deep dive into rices. And, you know, from there, just kind of built it out and really understood chemically how rice works and, you know, how yeast works and how these fermentations work and how, you know, all of it comes together. And so from there, we just kind of started to build the concept and build the business.
Interesting. Well, for listeners who aren't familiar with shochu, shochu is, you know, only around 25% alcohol level versus 40%, 45% of like whiskey or harder spirits. And the sake is 17, and wine's probably around like 12 to 13. So it's a hit the middle. And the shochu, in that sense, you know, baijiu probably is like very, very
yeah, it's like 65. It's way up there.
Right. But it's amazing, right? You just like a piece of article brought you to this whole different world. And I really admire you take action like that. It's just fascinating how you switched your life entirely to something very, very creative like that. So, yeah. And so before we dive into a conversation about your unique, very unique spirits, I stress, I'd like to talk about the definition of your products because you're so thoughtful about that. So, so according to the Japanese tax regulations, I looked up, and the premium shochu is defined as spirits distilled by a pot still. An alcohol level of the final product is under 45 degrees. Or if it's distilled by a continuous still, the alcohol level must be under 36 degrees. Also, in both cases, it does not fall into the categories of whiskey, brandy, vodka, rum, and gin. So this is a very tricky part of Japanese regulation. Doesn't fall into whiskey, which is very tricky. So that's another world of discussion.
Right.
But so all of your products are made from your four simple ingredients of rice, spring water, yeast, and black koji, and distilled by a pot still, and alcohol level is 40%. So that means you easily qualify for premium shochu, but you decided to call it your products as American rice koji spirits. So why is that? Why did you decide to call it?
Yeah. One, it was not an easy decision. We went back and forth about this a lot, and definitely wanted to honor the people that have been making this, you know, for the last 500 years. We certainly don't want to come off as a company that, you know, tries to pretend like we've created something new or a new category, because we certainly haven't. But it was several things. Really, to what you were saying about, you know, four simple ingredients, it's, you know, we are a honkaku shochu for all intents and purposes. We only use those four ingredients: rice, water, koji, and yeast. But we kind of blend the processes a little bit. And for anyone who, you know, knows a lot about how awamori is made, which is kind of a close cousin of shochu, or how honkaku shochu is made, we kind of take a little bit, you know, pieces of each one of those. And so for one, you know, the biggest difference is we're not using Japanese grains of rice like Yamada Nishiki or Omachi. That was kind of a big differentiator for us. But with awamori, they use long grain rice and black koji. We're not using a long grain rice, but we do use black koji. And whereas awamori is made using just one single shikomi, so just one single fermentation, we do a double shikomi process, which is more similar to traditional Japanese shochus. So we have a starter fermentation, which we later add more water and rice to make the fermentation bigger. And so for those reasons, we just felt like, you know what, there's a lot of things here that, you know, definitely fit within the category, and certainly fit within the processes of how you make it. I mean, it's a single pot distillation, you know, with whiskeys and vodkas and gins and all that stuff. Typically you have more distillation runs. So we're certainly more aligned with traditional Japanese shochu in that sense as well. But, just after having the conversations internally about, you know, is it appropriate to call this stuff a Japanese shochu if we're using different types of rices? It's not located within the boundaries of, you know, the country of Japan. We're really doing only a single shikomi when traditional shochu is a double shikomi. And we're also using black koji, whereas more traditional shochus use a yellow koji. We just felt like all those things combined, for the layperson, they probably wouldn't notice, but we could just see ourselves getting grilled by the more stringent shochu enthusiasts. So we made the decision to call it an American rice koji spirit. But, you know, one other thing that kind of goes along with that is that, you know, we're trying to target a broader American audience, you know, and especially in our region of the country in the Southeast. I mean, you know, the vast majority of people are familiar with sake, but I'd say that, you know, even, you know, within the sake category, people aren't necessarily overly informed about how it's made or the different varietals. And there's not as nearly as many people that are familiar with Sochu as a category. And so we see ourselves somewhat as a bridge. I mean, we're definitely proponents for Sochu and for all things Koji. But, you know, we're trying to bring more people kind of to our side. And we felt like by doing it as a kind of a broader marketing exercise that we could get in front of a lot more people.
Totally makes sense. Yeah, that's interesting. So for listeners who's not familiar with Shochu, Shochu basically, because of the nature of Koji have mainly three different types of Koji mold, white, yellow, and black. And black is suitable for hotter temperature, so it's often used for shochu making, and which you use. But then also our mori is more influenced. It's Okinawan type of spirits that's similar to shochu, but they use specific long grain rice, and also this production is a little different. We have another episode for that. So it really technically makes sense, right? Because what do you do is not pure shochu, but also you don't want to pigeonhole it in something that was a piece of this, piece of that. And it totally makes sense. And we discussed the flavor of your spirits later, but it totally makes sense. You don't want to call it shochu or something like, you know, like something you try to be in the category. Yeah.
And we tried, I'll add to that. I mean, we tried to get a lot of people's opinions on that too. I mean, even our distributor here in Georgia, there's a Japanese American that we work closely with, and he comes from a sake brewing family in Japan. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we had this conversation, just said, you know, we don't think that it's necessarily right that we call ourselves a Sochu. And, you know, we've had those conversations with a handful of different people, and have had a variety of different opinions. But ultimately, we feel like we took the right direction.
Right. And then Koji started being known as Japanese ingredient, but nowadays Koji can be applied to many other contexts by chefs and beverage producers. So this is an exciting step, one step outside again, outside of Japanese context. So yeah, this is very exciting to me personally.
I'll add to that real quick. I mean, the rice lees that are left over, we have a little bit of stuff that just gets, you know, the residual that's left behind before it goes into the still. We've sold that stuff now to restaurants, and we've had chefs come and pick that stuff up. And I mean, we've had people make cod dishes with it. I think somebody made a salmon dish out of it about 2 weeks ago. So to your point about that side, I mean, it's not just alcohol. I mean, we're getting people involved in more on the food and cuisine side of it as well.
Right. Yeah. Sake kasu. Right. That's a treasure. So, and let's talk about another ingredient of your spirit, which is very important. You mentioned, so you source all of your, you source, your rice from, family-owned farms across the southeast, I heard. So you mentioned the Carolina gold rice has a beautiful history. And maybe you can talk about the history and how it was first planted in the American South.
Yeah. So the origins of Carolina gold rice are, I wouldn't say completely unknown, but it goes back to the 1600s. It came here on a ship from a sailor that was coming from the African coast, and I believe his ship was actually shipwrecked off the coast of South Carolina. And in exchange for some work done to his ship, he gave the local shipbuilder some Carolina gold rice, and that eventually made its way to some farmers, and it started to take off in South Carolina. But back then, I mean, it was really just, you know, one of the colonies. I'm not even sure if they had made the differentiation between South and North Carolina at that point. But, you know, it's interesting. I mean, for the most part, the Carolina gold rice kind of has a little bit of a sordid past because it was one of the original cash crops, which was grown by slave labor. And so kind of fast forward to the Civil War, and following the Civil War, the South really went into just a huge economic depression. And Carolina gold rice production basically stopped almost completely. It went on for probably the following one or two decades, but then just fell out, I mean, totally. I mean, rice production started to move out to the Midwest, into the Louisiana and Mississippi, and largely in Arkansas. And rice continued to move out even further west. It eventually made its way out to California, to the Sacramento Valley. And so Carolina gold rice, I mean, it was largely lost. I think they actually thought that it went extinct for a long time. And then a doctor, an optometrist out of Savannah, Georgia, came across it at, I believe it was in a seed bank at the University of Texas. And he was able to source some of the seeds from that seed bank and started to plant it at his farm, and eventually grew enough to make it commercially viable, and really kind of started, you know, what is now the resurgence of Carolina gold rice.
I heard it's in the 80s, like pretty recent, right?
That's right. It was back in the 1980s. I mean, really, he was doing it to feed ducks. I mean, he was a hunter and was doing it because Carolina gold rice grows very well in nasty, wet, muddy conditions. And I think it was kind of an afterthought that he would actually be able to grow it commercially. I may be, you know, wrong on that point, but it took off, and I think people took notice. And so you started to get the attention of mills and restaurants. And all of a sudden there's this resurgence of Carolina gold rice. And so now, I mean, you can see it throughout South Carolina, North Carolina, and Georgia. You see it in a lot of, you know, chef-driven restaurants and nice grocery stores and stuff like that. So it has certainly come back. I will say, though, you can find it if anybody wanted to try it out or order some to use in a meal. You can find it for on retail websites like White House Farms, Ransom Mills has it for purchase. But, you know, it's grown in, you know, hundreds of thousands of pounds throughout the area, as opposed to rice that's grown by the millions, if not tens of millions of pounds in the Midwest and on the West Coast. So it's certainly prevalent in this area. But, you know, for all intents and purposes, it's still small scale to, you know, compared to some of the larger crops that are out there.
Right. And then how do you compare the Carolina gold rice with Japanese rice that is typically used to make traditional shochu?
Yeah, and so this is interesting, and this is kind of a point worth noting. Carolina gold rice, you know, we, along with a handful of other rices, we did chemical profiles to figure out which American grains of rice were best suited for our purposes. And so we compared them to Japanese grains of rice, and we looked at, you know, one was commercial viability, but, you know, other things like starch content, amylose content, to see, you know, what the yield would be like. And we found that, you know, Carolina gold rice and some others were actually very, very similar to Japanese strains of rice, that they had high starch and high amylose content, and therefore they'd be very good for making alcohol. One thing that we found with Carolina gold rice is that there's the characteristic is called chalkiness. I'm not sure what the technical term is, but essentially, it is not a very hard grain of rice. So Yamato Nishiki and Omachi, those are Omachi, are very hard grains of rice, and therefore they polish and they mill very well. Carolina gold rice does not mill very well. It breaks. I mean, the yield, if you have 10,000 pounds of Carolina gold rice in the field, I think you're lucky to probably get 50 to 60% of that ultimately gets bagged and out for sale. It just cracks. And so it's very hard to mill. It's very hard to polish. It's got a lot of other good characteristics going for it. But for that reason, you know, we've kind of had to figure out ways to work with it. And, you know, this is something we were talking about offline. The Carolina gold rice that we're using today, and we actually use a more aromatic subspecies of Carolina gold rice that's called Charleston gold rice. But we use Charleston gold rice in the oak barrel aged lines that we have now. The clear spirit that we have out on the market at present is made from a table rice that comes out of Arkansas. And it shares a lot of the same qualities, you know, a lot of the same chemical properties that it does with Carolina and Charleston gold rice. But, you know, when we stepped back and we looked at, you know, what are the volumes that we would like to do one day and, you know, how do we work with this rice and really the cost of the rice. I mean, when you look at the yield that comes out of these farms, and then you look at, you know, what's lost to the milling process, it makes for very expensive grain as well. And so, you know, with all of those factors taken into account, you know, we use this table rice to make our clear spirit. But then we do use Charleston gold rice in the barrel aged product that we have, which is underway right now. We've got a line called Southern Blend, which we're hoping to be able to release later this year, depending on hitting the flavor profile that we're trying to achieve.
Right. But I have to stress that the Carolina gold rice is the inspiration, right, in the first place. Without that rice, probably you didn't start this business. So it...
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's one of those things, like, it certainly was the inspiration. You know, I knew about Carolina gold rice, and that's kind of why I got into the whole concept. It just, you know, as you get further into it, you learn things about it. And not that it's a bad rice. I mean, you know, we certainly enjoy it. We like the flavor profiles that come from it. It's a very interesting rice. Again, it's just, you know, when you step back and you look at how difficult it can be to work with, and then you look at the, you know, the impact of price. I mean, on a per pound basis, it can be 8x.
But I smell. Yeah, I smell science of developing new crop that's going to be easy to mill coming out of looking at my goals. So maybe you could be a part of that project too. We'll see.
Yeah.
All right. So we'll take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll discuss what the terroir of Georgia and Japanese native koji malt create together. So please stay with us.
Eating Tools was born to showcase the artists, metalsmiths, woodworkers, and craftspeople behind the endless interpretations of the ancient tools that feed us. The curated collection of unique and extraordinary handmade culinary utensils you'll find at Eating Tools, along with a hand-picked selection of top-quality production-made pieces, presents a catalog of products never before assembled in one place. Food, cooking, craftsmanship, and art are their ingredients. For more information, visit eatingtools.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akio Katayama, and my guest today is Rick Johnson, who is the co-founder of Horizon Spirits, based in Atlanta, Georgia. Rick founded Horizon Spirits in April 2021 to produce very unique products that blend Japanese tradition and American terroir. So there's a big difference between your spirits and other American spirits, such as bourbon and white whiskey, regarding the fermentation process. So, and you use koji malt, as we discussed earlier, which is a key component of Japanese fermented products, including shochu, sake, soy sauce, and miso, whatever. It's delicious in Japanese cuisine. Whereas American spirits are made with malts. So could you tell us the technical difference between your koji malt-based fermentation and the malt-based fermentation?
Yeah, so I would say this is probably one of the largest differentiators between, I mean, really Western-based spirits, and you can throw, you know, all things whiskey in there, bourbons, whiskeys, scotches, gins, vodka, anything like that, which uses malted grains, versus shochu, which uses koji as the sacrification agent, which really does the same thing. And so, and even beer, I mean, I'd say scotch and whiskey and bourbon, all those things, but even beer uses malted grains. And essentially, when you malt a grain, what you're doing is to put it simply, you're tricking the grain into thinking that it's going to grow. And so all of the starches that are in the seed, the seed starts to release enzymes, and those enzymes start to break down the complex starches into simple sugars, which become food for the yeast to eat, and the yeast produces CO2 and alcohol. Well, when you use rice, you know, specifically the rices that are used for sake and shochu, those are polished rices. So the bran and the husk has been removed. And in that bran and in that husk, that's where the enzymes are located to break down the starches. So without those enzymes, you have to find another way to break those things down. And that's when you introduce the koji malt. And so the koji malt does the same thing as malting. It breaks down the starches into simple sugars in order to create food for the yeast. And each one, you know, each process has its own flavor profiles that come with it.
Okay. So, and also, so you could have made rice-based spirits like whiskey using malt, mm-hmm. but you chose koji-based products. So why is that?
Yeah. Rice, for one, it does not malt well. I mean, I can just tell you that from experience that I've had with, you know, even through our own endeavors, talking to other people that have tried to use rice. It doesn't malt like other grains, like barley does, or like rye. And so, you know, some people actually have to add enzymes into the fermentation in order to break down rice. So for those purposes alone, koji is the better way to go if you're looking to break down the starches into sugar. But the other thing is the flavor profiles that we feel we get from using koji are tremendous. And specifically using black koji. Black koji is great for us because, one, it produces a lot of citric acid. And in a warm environment, that helps to keep any kind of bacterial infections or bacterial growth in your fermentations down. But, it also creates this, you know, really unique fruitiness and this tropical flavor profile that, you really pick up in the fermentations. And ever since we got into this endeavor, I mean, it's interesting to smell and to taste what something is like when it's, you know, in a fermentation versus what the distillate tastes like, because you can really pick out, you know, those subtleties in the distillate that really come out very strong in the fermentation.
Interesting. And how well does your koji grow in Georgia's climate?
Yeah, so, well, I'll say that. I mean, the simple answer is that koji needs a lot of heat, and it needs a very particular amount of humidity in order to grow. It needs to be in the range of like 95 to 100 degrees really to have good growth. And you need to be able to wick water off it very quickly, in order to prohibit any kind of other, you know, mold or any kind of other bacterial growth from taking over. So the heat is good in that respect. The humidity is a little bit tougher to deal with, because even though you're steaming the rice and you want it to take on a certain amount of water, you need to be able to pull that water off pretty quickly. So we've kind of got a special environment where we can do both of those things. But the flip side is that the yeast wants it to be fairly cool. So we use sake yeast, and sake is kind of like on the opposite end of the spectrum that koji is. Whereas koji likes a lot of heat, the yeast likes it to be pretty cool. So our fermentation stays somewhere between, call it 55 to 65 degrees. So we've got to keep those a little bit cooler. But the tough part about being in Georgia is that there are some pretty wild temperature swings. Today, I want to say it's in the mid-50s, but just several days ago, there was, you know, an inch or two of snow on the ground. Summers in Georgia can be in the triple digits and feel like they're in the quadruple digits with the humidity. I mean, it just gets extremely hot. But again, I mean, in the winter in Georgia, you can have it drop down in the teens and you can have a lot of snow. So there are some really good months for both fermentations and for both koji growth. Those tend to be the milder months. But, you know, you kind of got to step in and do a little bit of control in the really hot months and the really cold months, because it almost gets to extremes in those months.
Wow. That's tricky but exciting challenges. And how's the water quality at Twizen? Is it good for making premium spirits?
Yeah, so we work specifically with a spring water company out of central Georgia called Callaway. It's another family-owned business. They have a land conservation easement that surrounds their spring in central Georgia. And it comes from a very deep quartzite mine. And so for that reason, I mean, you know, you talk to any kind of shochu producer, and even more so with the sake producers, I mean, they'll really stress, you know, the importance of water quality. And for those reasons, you know, we partnered with Callaway, and we've been working with them over the last like year or two to put their water in our fermentations. But one kind of, you know, important thing to note is that when it comes to dilution of the spirit, right? I mean, the final ABV of our distillations is usually in the range of kind of about 50 to 50% plus ABV. And so that has to be diluted back to 40%. We do not use spring water for those dilutions because any kind of minerality or any kind of elements that are in the water when it comes to dilution will create kind of a cloudiness. But again, I mean, the importance is when, you know, the fermentation, when you've got the yeast consuming the sugars and when you've got the koji really taking off. I mean, that's when you want to use that mineral water. And so we feel like it makes a tremendous impact.
Right. Yeah, I think your spirit has a lot of complexity, probably because of the elements. And so now, how do you describe the style of your spirits? What do the terroir of Georgia and the Japanese native koji malt create together in the environment?
Yeah. Well, as far as the style goes, I mean, we intentionally made our spirit 40% ABV. You know, more traditional shochus are, like you said, I mean, kind of in that 25%. ABV plus or minus range. We did that again, just kind of trying to target our customer base to make it a little bit more familiar. So it's closer to a vodka, you know, it's probably a little less than what a typical gin is, but it fits more in line with categories that people are familiar with. But you know, as far as the taste and the profile goes, it's really interesting. It's a single distillation. And for, you know, anybody that may be unaware of, you know, what that means, you know, when you make a rum or a whiskey or a bourbon, I mean, they do multiple distillations. And in terms of like a vodka, I mean, a vodka, if you're using column still, can have 8 to 10 plates where you're essentially doing 8 to 10 distillations. And so you're really removing the flavor profile of that underlying grain. With us, I mean, we just get that one pass doing a single distillation. So we've got to make sure that we do a really good job making our cuts. To get, you know, the best hearts. But, you know, you get this unique spirit where it captures kind of the graininess and the nuttiness of the underlying rice. But there's also that subtle sweetness that's there from the breakdown of the starches into the sugars. And then, again, I mean, a lot of the flavor comes from using that black koji. You get these kind of, you know, tropical fruity profiles. And so you get this drink that... Now, it's extremely smooth, I'll say that. I mean, and I can say that with a very straight face that we've given this to a lot of people, and the one comment that we receive over and over again is just how smooth the spirit is. But to your point, I mean, you get this great complexity of these, you know, these undertones of the base grain, but you get the subtle sweetness and then all these kind of like tropical and fruitiness that go with it. So it's very interesting.
Right. So now let's talk about your actual products then. So you have two products that are very different from each other. And one is Harvest Select that is currently available. And the other one is Southern Blend, which is going to be available later this year, you said. So could you tell us the theme of each product and their flavor profiles?
Right. So the flavor profile that I was just kind of talking about was our Horizon Harvest Select. And so that's our clear spirit. It's 40% ABV. And like I said, it's made to kind of fall in line with more recognizable clear spirit categories like a vodka or a gin. The Southern Blend, that is our product line that is a combination of both the rices we use in Harvest Select, as well as Charleston Gold Rice. And so, you know, we intentionally used Charleston Gold Rice because it's even more aromatic than Carolina Gold Rice. And so you get a lot of those, you know, very interesting kind of underlying elements from the base grain. But, you know, at the same time, it's barrel aged and we're only letting it sit for about 12 months or so. I mean, we'll see what the final times turn out to be once we decide to pull that product out of the barrel. We're hoping that's going to be about mid-year of this year. But, you know, it shares some more characteristics with a traditional whiskey. I mean, it's barrel aged, so you're going to get kind of those oaky flavors. But, you know, we're using No. 4 charred barrels, so you're getting a good correspondence kind of back and forth going through the char of the inside of the barrel. And you get some of those spicy notes. And I'd add to that, you know, it almost helps to kind of preserve and bring out even more some of the subtle sweetness. You know, you get these kind of like maple undertones that come out of the stuff that's barrel aged. So they're, there's certainly some similarities that they share, but there's also some big differences. Mm. So, you know, whereas the clear spirit, I mean, it's going to be more for those people that are, you know, vodka and gin drinkers, whereas our barrel aged spirit is going to be more aligned with those people that like to have a whiskey or a bourbon.
Mm. I'm just curious. So number four, charred barrel. So is it kind of similar to bourbon barrels, how it's charred?
Yeah, so it's very similar. In fact, we're using new American oak barrels. So they, you know, they haven't been used for anything else. It's not like these barrels have been used for whiskey and then we're reusing them. They haven't been used for wine or anything like that, or and then we're reusing them. These are new oak barrels. And, you know, as far as the char goes, it's on a scale of 1 to 5. You know, if you use a number one barrel, it's a light kind of toastiness. And when you do that, you get a lot more of the kind of the tannins and the taste of the oak. Whereas if you go all the way up to a 5, I mean, there's a heavy char to the barrel. You're getting a lot more of those spicy notes and a lot more filtration through the char that's on the inside.
Okay. And by the way, I tasted the Harvest Select, and here are some words it came out of my mouth or mind. So the nose was caramel and sage and lemongrass, and it became a toasted walnuts, and that was exciting. And then taste was like milk chocolate and coconut and custard over time. Mm-hmm. So I never tasted anything like this when I had any specific shochu or gin or vodka independently. So I think this is a new category, I think.
Yeah. I mean, again, kind of to your point, I mean, it's, you know, it's something different. I mean, traditional shochus, a lot of them are vacuum distilled. And so they're very light, they're very airy. And there's a lot of subtle sweetness to them. You know, doing an atmospheric distillation like we do, it makes them a little bit bolder. So I think if you're going to go out there and try a traditional rice Kome Shochu, you're going to kind of pick up on those differences. But at the same time, it's going to be very different than a vodka. You know, I always caution people when they see that we make a clear spirit and they see that it's 40% ABV and they say, well, is it essentially like a vodka? Can you use it like a vodka? And the answer is yes, in some regards, but it's not a vodka. I think that it mixes well with a lot of, you know, different cocktail recipes. But, you know, because it does have this flavor profile, it doesn't work in every single thing that vodka does, right? Because vodka, for all intents and purposes, is just a neutral spirit. I mean, it's been intentionally made. It's been intentionally distilled numerous times and carbon filtered, you know, with the purpose of basically removing all of the flavor of the underlying grain.
Right. So distinctively more notes, more taste flavor elements that hit your nose and your tongue. So yeah, you can't use that like vodka. It's too precious to do that. What a complexity. Right. But I had it, you have a sex on the rocks, but what's the best way to taste your products other than, you know, on the rocks?
Yeah. When we're out there talking with people and meeting with people, I'm always kind of curious to know, well, it's like, well, what kind of drinker are you? We always recommend, I mean, if you're the kind of person that likes to sip a drink, if you're the kind of person that likes to, you know, have a whiskey neat or have a whiskey with a cube of ice or something like that, we recommend the same thing. And just because of the underlying flavor profile and the palate of our spirit, you know, if you're the kind of person that enjoys a drink like that, we recommend it. That's a great way to kind of understand and taste, you know, the essence of the spirit. You know, if you don't like it at room temperature neat, we recommend putting in, you know, a cube of ice or maybe a splash of cold water just to kind of open it up a little bit. You know, that'll enhance the nose as well. But, you know, for people that are more into cocktails and want to mix it up a little bit, I mean, it does well with any kind of fruit juices, does well with sours. I mean, it goes well in a lot of different things. I can say that it's not one that lends well to anything that's briny. I've tried personally, to put it in a Bloody Mary that's got a heavy vinegar brine or something like that. And I can tell you just, it clashes with stuff that's salty. But outside of that, I mean, it's, you know, and I would encourage anyone, I mean, if you're looking for recipes or, you know, ways to pair it with other things, certainly go to our website or look at our Instagram page. because we've got cocktail recipes that came through or came to us through some of our early partners. But, you know, with the restaurants and the bars that we're working with now, I mean, you know, whenever they're willing to share with us their cocktail recipes, we'll throw them on there. So there's a plethora of stuff to take a look at on there as well.
Okay, that's awesome. I will take a look. And so when is the Southern Blend going to be available? That you have like vague plans, sounds like, but do you have any specific like a fall or later this year?
Yeah, this middle of this summer, it will have sat for about a year. I think the intention is to take it out around that time, but really it just depends on what the flavor profile is like. I mean, we crack those barrels open from time to time to do samples and tastings and kind of see where they are. And it's certainly changing over time. But what we don't want to do is take something out that we feel like, you know, needs to sit in there a little bit longer if we're going to get a better flavor profile out of it. And so, you know, the summertime is going to be very different, you know, with warmer temperatures. It's going to move the distillate around in those barrels a good bit more. It's going to be going in and out of the charcoal, so you're going to get a little bit better filtration. So it depends. I mean, I'll say that middle of this year is the target. But again, we're not in any kind of rush to go out and release something that we don't feel confidently about.
Right. Mm. So that's a live creature, so you can't tell.
That's right. Like,
and but currently, where can we find your Harvest Select?
Yeah. So unfortunately, right now we're only in Georgia. We're predominantly in Atlanta, but we're also in Savannah. We're working on some distribution options in the Carolinas as well, but we're also working on a DTC or a direct-to-consumer option as we speak. I'm hoping that we have that ready in the next couple of weeks. And if, you know, if there's anybody out there that certainly wants to try a bottle, I'd say, you know, go and follow us on Instagram because we post updates periodically. And that's certainly one thing that we're putting, you know, out there for people. So once we have that as an option, we'll definitely put it out there for everyone to see and, you know, have one shipped directly to your door.
Right. And then whoever got lucky to be able to taste your products, what do they say about your products?
Yeah. You know, it's a lot of the same stuff that we've been talking about. It's, you know, it's different. It's interesting. Love the sweet profiles of it. Love how smooth it is. But I'll say this, I mean, 95% of our accounts right now, I take that back. 75% of our accounts are on premise. So bars and restaurants, and about 95% of those accounts, we're on the cocktail menu. And I can tell you, just working with the bartenders and the mixologists and, you know, my partner getting out there and talking with all of these people, I mean, people have really enjoyed kind of having a new base to play with, you know. I mean, it's a completely different category for somebody to get out there and start playing around with. And so we've had a lot of people get excited about it. You know, we've got some restaurants that just, you know, they've kept us on the cocktail menu literally for months. I mean, we've got one restaurant in particular that I think we've probably been on their cocktail menu for about 4 months. And just, you know, they're constantly coming up with new cocktail recipes and they've just enjoyed having it on there. And, you know, they love the customer feedback that they're getting as well.
Right. If I were a bartender, I would be excited because there's so many multiple aspects on your palate, right, to your nose too. So, and have you ever let Japanese shochu experts or producers to taste your spirit?
Yeah. So for one, the individual that I mentioned earlier is a Japanese American that works with our distributor. And he was the one that I was saying he comes from a sake brewing family in Japan. We engaged him really early on. I mean, this was probably 2 years ago before we had even released product into the market. And, you know, really confided in him. And, you know, the response that we got back from him was very positive. And he shared it with a lot of the bars and restaurants that he covers in Atlanta, and introduced us to a lot of people in the Japanese scene. And, you know, got very positive responses from them as well. But to my knowledge, you know, the Christopher Pellegrini and Steven Lyman, the two guys that you had on your show a little while back, you know, we shared it with those guys. They actually took a bottle back with them to Japan. They really enjoyed it. From what I've heard, we've actually had a bottle that has shown up in Singapore. And so, yeah, I mean, the reactions that we've kind of, that we've got really from, you know, traditional Western-based drinkers versus, you know, people that are more familiar with Japanese and Asian spirits in particular. I mean, we've gotten positive responses from both.
I really totally trust Christopher and Steven's palate. They are like the geeks of shochu.
Yeah, and I'll add, I mean, those guys have been great. I mean, you know, they've been extremely supportive and helpful. And on top of that, I mean, yeah, they're extremely knowledgeable about shochu. And those guys, I mean, we're kind of coming at it from a different angle as them. But I think we're like-minded in the fact that we're trying to promote all things Koji. You know, we want to support other shochu producers that are out there. We definitely like to see the category grow here in the United States. I mean, we think that, you know, alcohol that's made with Koji is superior and just, you know, we're strongly aligned with it.
Right. I mean, to me, you just cracked the open of the door to developing some shochu-based products. I mean, there are really great sake breweries now in America, but I think you kind of started something interesting. That's my impression.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say this. I mean, we're starting to see it really pick up. I mean, Christopher and Steven are doing a great job getting out there and educating people about the category. But you just, you see it kind of here, there, and everywhere. It's in the trade magazines, the Artisan Spirit. You know, I follow those guys, and they've done numerous articles in the last year where, I mean, they dedicated several issues just to the discussion about sake and then just to the discussion about shochu. So we're seeing it more and more. And, you know, it definitely aligns well with the growth that we've seen in Japanese whiskey. You know, in the last decade, people have seen Japanese whiskey really take off. And I think people are starting to really take a notice of, you know, more than just whiskey coming out of Japan. And, you know, we'd love it if shochu continued to grow up. We think that there's, you know, that's a very, very deep category that has really yet to be explored by a lot of people.
Right. Okay. So what are your plans and dreams?
Yeah. So for us, you know, as I wouldn't say it's necessarily difficult. It's certainly been tough to get to where we are today, but it's also been hard to kind of to produce this stuff because we're having to work in a facility with a guy that has been, you know, gracious enough to let us work with him to produce our spirits in his facility. But we'd like to have our own home. I mean, it's just, you know, you don't find as much of the equipment that traditional shochus are making. And so we're having to do things with equipment that's more suited to making whiskey than, you know, steaming 800 pounds of rice. So we'd love to have our own home and to have our own distillery. In fact, that's something that we're going to embark on this year. I'd love to say that we'd have something launched in 2023. Time will tell on that. But it is our primary goal right now to find a way to get out there to have our own distillery and really showcase, I mean, everything that we're doing. I mean, we've had a lot of people that have asked, you know, what does it look like when you're, you know, propagating and growing Koji mold, and what do these fermentations smell and look like, and, you know, what all does a single distillation process entail? And so we've just had a lot of people inquire about it, and we'd love to be able to kind of show this stuff off to people because, you know, for the most part, people have never seen it. So as far as the future outlook and our dreams, I mean, that's a big one for us, is we'd like to be able to have our own home and be able to showcase what we're doing for everybody to see.
Awesome. So, well, keep me posted. We can discuss it again maybe on the show sometime when it happens.
Sure.
So, yeah. And where can we find you online and on social media?
Yeah, so our website is www.horizonspirits.com, and Horizon is Horyzon. We are at Horizon Spirits for Instagram, and they're also on Facebook. And just kind of a quick, you know, nod to what we're doing. Why, you know, people ask, well, why do you spell horizon with a Y? For one, everything obviously that we're doing kind of like ties back into rice. And if you look at the Latin root for rice, it's oryza, so O-R-Y-Z-A. And you'll see on our label, and there's kind of a little icon of a bird's head that you'll see on our on the label also, but also on our website. And the bird is a bobolink. And the Latin name for the bobolink is oryza vorish, which literally translates into eats or devours rice. But the bobolink is this notorious bird that migrates through the southeastern United States. And we think it's a fun little mascot, but you talk to farmers about it and they can't stand it because it just decimates rice fields. I mean, they'll have it move through there in the fall, kind of like right before the harvest. And it can eat thousands of pounds of rice in a day. I mean, not an individual bird, but flocks of birds can eat thousands of pounds of rice in a day. And so it's kind of fun for us, but obnoxious for others. But, you know, horizon, I mean, that's also kind of a nod just to the Japanese as well. I mean, the bird, our emblem, is looking to the east. And, you know, that's in reverence to the fact that, look, I mean, you know, we're definitely creating something new here. But at the same time, I mean, we're standing on the shoulders of giants as far as what the Japanese have done really in the last 500 years to create this category and as wide ranging as it is. So.
Right. Well, I'm glad to hear the origin of the name and the label, because the label is very beautiful too. So,
thank you.
All right. So good luck. And thank you so much for joining us today, Bit.
All right. Well, thank you as well. And I appreciate it.
All right. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japaneseats@heritageradionetwork.org or akikotema.com. Japanese is a weekly program and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, as well on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer is Armin Spengen, and thank you for listening. I will see you next week.
Japanese is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.